WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV with your host, Rebecca Terrell. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today is Thursday, March 9th. I'm Paul Dragoo, and I'm filling in for Rebecca Terrell. Here are some of the stories we're following today. While the COVID-19 virus and its authoritarian baggage is mostly gone, much-needed discussion about its origin is coming back. Yesterday, the House Select Committee on the Coronavirus Pandemic held a hearing, and Republican Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio questioned Dr. Redfield, the former director of the CDC. In this exchange, Jordan and Redfield established that Dr. Anthony Fauci knew very early on that the virus probably came out of a lab. Let's take a look.
Dr. Redfield, you ran the CDC and you were on the coronavirus task force. Is that right?
Correct.
That was formed on January 29th, 2020. Is that right?
Correct.
2 days later, Dr. Fauci gets an email from Dr. Anderson, which says what? Virus looks engineered, virus not consistent with evolutionary theory. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding.
Did he share that email with you, by the way, Dr. Redfield?
No.
As a member of the task force, as a head of CDC, did he share that email with you?
No.
Okay. Next day, February 1st, Dr. Gary sends Dr. Fauci another email. That email says, I don't know how this happens in nature, but it would be easy to do in a lab. Did he share that email with you, Dr. Redfield?
No.
You didn't see either one of those emails, even though you're head of CDC, even though you're on the coronavirus task force that had been formed just 2 days, 3 days earlier.
No.
3 days later, Dr. Anderson and Dr. Gary, who told us it came from a lab and emails to Dr. Fauci that Dr. Fauci wouldn't let Dr. Redfield see, 3 days later, they changed their position 180 degrees. The question is why?
Yeah, why? Why did Fauci work so hard to silence the lab leak theory? Here's what science writer and former New York Times science editor Nicholas Wade had to say.
Well, if you're looking at the timeline, on May 21st, a few weeks after the Nature Medicine article had come out, two of the signatories of the original email to Dr. Fauci, that's Dr. Anderson and Dr. Gary, were awarded a $9 million grant for the
So there's reason. 9 million reasons why they changed their mind. I knew you'd get to it. I read that last night.
And as mounting evidence points more to a lab leak, now that we're allowed to discuss it, there's another crackpot theory that will soon be too obvious to ignore. The Epoch Times newspaper recently interviewed insurance research analyst Josh Sterling. Mr. Sterling released data showing that the more vaccines there are, the more all-cause mortality.
If the vaccine was helpful at reducing all-cause mortality, you would see that the more doses a region, state of Vermont or Maine or Hawaii or Connecticut or someplace that's pretty highly vaccinated, you would see lower levels of mortality year over year because people got more vaccines than in other places, which who didn't do as much for whatever reason, and you would see an improvement and you would see a line that slopes down to the right. Instead, when we did that analysis, and we cut it a number of different ways, we did it by different type of city and region, and we did it by age group as well. So we did some thoughtful to make sure there wasn't a bias in it. But no matter which way you do it, what you end up seeing is the chart goes, the line that you create, a regression line, goes up and to the right, which is to simply to say that the more doses on average you have in a region within the United States, the bigger increase in mortality that region has had in 2022 when compared to 2021.
The more doses you have in a region, the bigger increase in mortality that region has. Absolutely amazing. So joining me to discuss this and other stories is the publisher of the New American magazine, Dennis Barron.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me on today.
Dennis, it looks like the conspiracy theorists are proving to be right.
Well, I think that's been a trend that's been increasingly apparent now for quite a while. I think it's interesting that the data showing that the more doses in the regions of the U.S., the more mortality is increasing. That's a really interesting development because I've seen data from Europe and a couple of places in Europe that were indicating that some time ago already. And so to see that further confirmed here in the U.S. is fairly striking. I think more research continues to be needed on that front. But so far, what we're seeing is the conspiracy theory that the vaccine is dangerous has certainly not been falsified if you look at it as a hypothesis. In fact, it's looking like maybe it's more dangerous than anyone certainly would have hoped for, certainly expected not to see this. And we really have to grapple with the fact that we've had a cover-up. We've had a very strong cover-up. The cover-up was to prevent recriminations on the origin, which traces back to potential gain-of-function research. So that's, even if it's a mistake with a lab leak, you know, there's going to have to be some accountability there. But following up with regard to that mistake has been this mass vaccination campaign, which followed on mass lockdown campaigns all across the world, where everyone's rights were wantonly violated by governments that were increasingly insistent on using fear to get their way against their own citizens. This is governments acting against their own citizens. That is a moral outrage. It's an ethical crime, and it may be a de facto crime. And that's why we're seeing these efforts at covering up, because at some point accountability will be required.
It is astounding that the number of like we said, cover-ups, and he knew early on that there was a chance this, but then they were so vehement that that wasn't the case. And then, of course, they got their media organs to toe the line and to quash all conversation, public conversation. But the damage, we're not even at the end of the damage. There was a massive campaign to try to get these things in the kids.
That continues.
And we know that people are starting to get it, if for no other reason, and let me know if you agree, for the fact that booster intake is low. I don't know if I believe it's anywhere between 5 and 15%, right? Which is much, much lower than what was the in the U.S. at least. It was upward of 60%. Original. We, of course, at the New American, and even you, I mean, you were on top of it. And for instance, we did an issue not some time ago called the biggest medical experiment in history. Is it possible that this might be the biggest crime in history?
Well, I don't think I have to be the one to say it, because other people are saying that. There are people we've interviewed here from the New American magazine who have come on from the perspective of other massive crimes that took place in their lifetimes, going all the way back to mid-20th century. And they themselves have said that this looks like a repeat on a wider scale of these horrific examples of crimes committed against entire peoples that they witnessed, that they were victims of, that their parents were victims of. So this is not something that we can overlook. This has been a campaign of governments against their own citizens. Perhaps it was for the aggrandizement of power and the collectivization of power at higher levels.
Yeah.
Whatever the case may be, the operative end result was citizens were harmed by the activities of their own governing bodies. And that is antithetical to our system here in the United States, which is a constitution creating a government of, by, and for the people, not against the people. And this has to be redressed, because we can't go forward with a government that works actively against the interests of its own people.
It'd be interesting to see where this goes. And thank goodness that they're doing these hearings.
Well, it's about time. And, you know, Congressman Jordan, he's, as you can see from the examples that you played, he's a fiery interrogator.
Yeah.
And it's good to see someone within Congress trying to do their best to get to the truth. It doesn't matter who it is. Jim Jordan is in that role currently.
Yeah.
Let's all pray for him and wish for him the best, because, you know, there'll be a temptation by some people to say this is an ideological attack that he's engaged in. He's a hardcore rightist playing politics. The fact is, the American people deserve to know the truth about what's been done to them. And if it takes a Jim Jordan to have these hearings, if it takes a Ron Johnson to have these hearings, I don't really care who's doing it or from what party. The truth is what matters here, and hard questions need to be asked. It's refreshing to see someone do that. So pray for Jim Jordan. Let's hope he does a good job. I think he will.
Yeah.
And information that all Americans need is going to come from this.
Yeah, and let's hope that this is going to be further uncovered, and if nothing else, that it serves as a lesson going in the future. Because I'm kind of terrified of what's going to continue to happen from these shots. You have done a lot of reporting on that, and it's not looking good. So, and speaking of injections, the Biden administration is looking at another mass vaccination campaign, this time on chickens. The official narrative is that this is for our own good. So the New York Times reported Monday that the Biden administration is keeping a watchful eye on an outbreak of avian flu among humans and the cost of eggs, and therefore contemplating a mass vaccination campaign for poultry. But even the Times admits in its reporting that the chances of a human pandemic are low. So there might be a bit more to this story than our government's paternal benevolence. It turns out that the CEO of the manufacturer of the bird flu vaccine, Kristin Peck, used to work at Pfizer. She also sits on the board of directors of BlackRock, the largest asset fund manager in the world, and the same entity using its leverage to bully companies into complying with its economically destructive and pseudo-Marxist ESG standards. And in England, a preacher was arrested and convicted after having the gall not to play along with the delusions of a man who insisted he was a woman. The English justice system sentenced David McConnell to 80 hours of community service and ordered him to pay a £620 fine, about $735, for misgendering. Check this out.
Men and women in Leeds, Jesus didn't like come to condemn you. Jesus came to save you. Let me tell you who I am. My name is David, and I'm a Christian preacher.
I knew that I wasn't being treated the way I should be treated in that situation.
This is where I was set up. This is where the crowd began to gather.
Does God accept the LGBT community?
This gentleman asked a question. Does God accept the LGBT community?
Yes, this is the first for me, being arrested for so-called misgendering someone.
You're aware she's a woman?
No, I'm fully aware that this is a man.
It's absolutely worrying. You know, just because somebody feels like a woman or they believe they're a woman, if we simply say, no, I don't agree with you, I believe that you are a man, you can be arrested for that and prosecuted for that.
In a related story, across the pond in the good old USA, sanity actually prevailed. On March 2nd, Tennessee Governor Bill Lee signed in the bills intended to protect children from trans madness in the volunteer state. Governor Lee signed a ban on gender reassignment surgeries and hormone treatments for children. He also signed a bill barring children from seeing drag shows where men dress as hypersexualized females. Dennis, one issue, two different stories. Is this reflective of the struggle, the culture struggle that we're experiencing right now?
Well, I think it's reflective of something far deeper, and I think that's the normalization or the mainstreaming of transitioning from humanity to something else. When I look at these trans issues, whatever they are, however you define them, they always seem to revolve around the dehumanization of what had come before as what everyone understood to be the essence and, you know, the biological fact of and the human essence of human biology. It's transitioning from that. It's interesting that this is arising in a couple of different ways. One, it's within the context of a larger movement, which I've written about, and which many other people have written about, to move to a post-human future. It's not a term that I've invented, but it's a term that's used widely in the literature for transhumanism, to move to something post-human. You first have to mainstream the idea that whatever is currently known to be human can be malleable, can be optional, and can be transitioned to something else. That makes that notion no longer revolutionary. It makes it mainstream, and you have to get that across first as part of the intellectual milieu of the population you're hoping to take through that transitioning to a post-human future. The other thing is you can't have debate over this. If you want to be successful, you have to stifle debate. And what are we seeing right now? We're seeing the rise of the most aggressive censorship campaigns the Western world has seen in the modern era. You know, it used to be a non-controversial subject for anyone, regardless of where they fall on the political spectrum, to celebrate the rights of free speech, the inherent necessity of people being able to express their opinions and to be able to practice their religion. And that's enshrined right in our Bill of Rights here in the United States. That's being overthrown as we speak, that effort. There's a concerted effort to overthrow that concept in our constitutional law, as well as in our moral and ethical behavior. And you have to step back and look at this as with a question. Why is that taking place? Well, it's because the people who want to get to a post-human future, they want to stifle the debate on that. And of course, they want to stifle the debate on anything that goes against the idea of an all-powerful government, because an all-powerful government ultimately will be necessary to force that post-human future into existence.
And that's the truth behind the news, because I bet you most people, they don't understand that aspect. I know people who are therapists, psychologists, and whatnot, and that's another concerning aspect of this, that the institutions, I don't know if it's supposed to be those, you know, who are psychologists or some aspect of the medical institutions or the elements, should be the first to say, this is madness. This is, if there ever was a sign that existed that something is wrong, mentally ill, like this is a, you know, we have a problem with, you know, a pandemic of mental illness. This would be it. But they don't seem to be. I know there has been some, and I know we've reported on various associations and things like that, or at least doctors within them saying this is problematic. But where in the world are all the medical associations, all the medical experts saying this is a problem? We have a problem. There's people here walking in grand delusions, and furthermore, we're encouraging that. This is going to be really problematic for society, you know. But like you said, it's like that's another thing. It's like most people don't know. It's like this is, they think it's about rights. It's about accepting, tolerance, celebrating diversity. And, you know, when you tell them, I've read your book, of course, and we've talked about it in various broadcasts. I don't think even people would be able to swallow that pill, that this is about a transhuman future. But it is. It is. And you did a bang-up job footnoting that. So good job.
Yeah, they won't be able to swallow that pill. I fully understand that. It sounds impossible. It sounds too far out in terms of science fiction.
Yeah.
And I guess the way I respond to that is I'm not the one creating these things. I'm not the one saying these things that are out there. Like you said, I footnoted everything. I cited everything. Yeah. You can go ahead and read these things for yourself. I'm just merely reporting what's in the literature and what people are saying. But where the rubber meets the road is where people are willing to put their money.
Yeah.
And billions of dollars are invested in this.
Yeah.
Billions of dollars by our largest, most influential corporations, and you know, influence is being bought and paid by lobbyists. We have political leaders behind these efforts, and so at the top levels of our sociocultural armature, if you will, this is a key project. And you know, because the mainstream doesn't know about it, makes that easier for that project to move forward. And it really, you know, to move forward into a constructive way. The American people specifically, because I'm mostly concerned about the United States, but the world's people generally need to start to come to grips with what's taking place at these levels and understand it and be aware. Because being taken unawares means they're going to be, you know, their fate will be determined by someone else, and that's just not consistent with human ethics.
Well, for our last story, she's back. So on Wednesday, former Secretary of State and twice-failed presidential candidate Hillary Clinton attended the Forbes 3050 Summit in Abu Dhabi in celebration of International Women's Day, where she accused the climate of misogyny.
Women and children are the primary victims of conflict and of climate change, and there is no place that unfortunately, tragically, shows us that more dramatically than Ukraine today, but there are a lot of other conflicts, a lot of other challenges that we have to take into account as we look at gender apartheid in Afghanistan, the persecution and oppression of girls and women exercising their freedom of choice in Iran and so many other places.
Dennis, I don't think anyone can deny that war and obviously, specifically what's happening over there in Ukraine and Russia is hurting civilians, is killing civilians and whatnot. But she never, as far as I heard, never came close to even explaining how it disproportionately hurts women and children. As far as we know, the dying and the fighting that's being carried and incurred by men. So it's just another, it sounds just like politics, gender politics and whatnot. And it's darn tragic, huh?
Well, it's mere propaganda for a purpose, which has been, you know, her consistent purpose for many years, to downplay the role that men play in society. But the fact is that it hurts men first, it hurts all families, it hurts all people, and war should not be undertaken unless it's a defensive in nature. And we have a case here where you can't make a claim that this is defensive in nature by either party. This is an offensive war of choice that's taking place, and it's killing people. It's hurting families. It's destroying children's lives, and it's destroying men.
Yeah.
So let's just be honest about that. It's It's all people are being destroyed by war when war occurs, and that's why it's a colossal evil in our midst. Secondarily, to blame it on climate change, that doesn't follow logically. I don't think there's any climate change component to anything happening
in
Ukraine
madness.
Or Russia. Yeah, it's mere word salad for the need to have words on a screen.
Well, thanks,
with the agenda.
We've run out of time, and thank you for your time. And thank you for tuning in, and we will see you on the other side of this break.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board, and I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
The truth is hard to find, but the New American has it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.
On February 23rd, family physician Dr. John Littell testified before the Sarasota County Public Hospital Board in Florida about successfully treating COVID-19 with ivermectin. He saw the event as an opportunity to share his observations and be the voice of those who were trapped in hospitals and denied early treatments during the Delta wave. Little did he know that three police officers would escort him out afterward. Let's take a look at the video.
What were the outcomes that we had? And we used an independent third party who basically said we had 24% better outcomes than our peer group.
Have to move.
Morning. I just wanted to let her know I'm wearing this white coat. I'm not employed. I'm not a contracted physician. I'm able to speak my mind. That's why I asked. So thank you for your advocacy, for patience and help.
Wow, this is how it's done here.
All right. Second thing is to follow the money. I'm kind of a numbers guy. And did the hospital benefit, or was there any?
You're not allowed to record out here.
You can videotape the public.
So can't videotape him? What are we doing to him? Interesting. He said, I can't video what's happening out there.
In this interview with the New American's Veronica Karolinko, Dr. Littell talks about why he went to the board meeting, what he discussed, and how a seemingly innocent protocol violation got him expelled. He also says that suppression of early treatments, along with other pandemic measures such as the promotion of untested and unnecessary vaccines, is affecting male and female fertility. He believes this is part of a population control plan. Here's the interview.
Today, I'm privileged to speak with Dr. Littell, who has been widely praised as a hero. Dr. Littell, welcome and thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, I'm glad I could be here, Veronica. I'm glad my patients cooperated.
Wonderful. Yes. And thank you. Doctor, I'm grateful to journalist Chris Nelson, who caught the incident on camera and who then interviewed you afterwards. I'm even more grateful for your testimony, and it looks like the attendees enjoyed it as well. But first and foremost, please tell us about the meeting's agenda and why you were there.
Well, I was struggling whether or not to go in the first place, because as I'm talking to you, I'm in my office now and my schedule as a solo family doctor is busy. But it dawned on me as we got closer to the date that I would be the only physician actually at the meeting representing the patients who were in the COVID units. And you see, I'm kind of in an interesting position. I'm one of the few doctors, it seems to me anymore, that actually go to the hospital and take care of my own patients. That's my commitment to my patients. And I've even told medical students, I say, you don't get into medicine to abandon your patients when they're at their sickest, right? Which seems to be a common trend. But, you know, I always make a point wherever I've been practicing of being able to at least keep some level of privileges in the hospitals. So during that COVID time, especially Delta wave, I saw a lot of horrible things, and I felt it was important to share those stories with the people in Sarasota, which was a unique opportunity because it's a public hospital that allowed for public comment, or so I thought it would allow for more public comment. They kind of stacked the deck against us, but that's a second issue. I felt I could take that I needed to take the 2.5-hour drive down there to Sarasota from Ocala, Florida, where I am now, just to be able to be a voice for those family members and their loved ones, the ones who were trapped inside hospital walls during Delta. That was my reason for going.
So what exactly did you say during the meeting? What was your testimony about?
Well, my testimony would have been longer if I'd had more time. And I think that's why I insisted on getting at least an extra few seconds. But it was really just to say, here is what happened with the patients who were being denied treatments, predominantly ivermectin. So the story is like this. People were told during Delta variant, the Delta wave, to just go to the emergency room when their oxygen levels dropped. And then they were put into these COVID units in isolation from their family members and their advocates. And they were put on CDC protocols, and which led in many cases to death on a ventilator. All right. So there were the big steps that could have taken place between them showing up in the ER. Obviously, the idea was to keep them out of the hospital, and the ventilator would have been to give them the multi-drug regimen that many of us physicians had already implemented around the world, and which was effective, including ivermectin, high-dose steroids, high-dose anticoagulants. This was something that we saw working in the outpatient setting, and I had seen could work in the inpatient setting if the hospitals would allow me to do it. And I wanted to present to the hospital the cases where I was able to get ivermectin. I used the example of the mayor of one town who was a big shot, obviously, and they allowed him to get ivermectin, but they wouldn't allow other patients to get it. He was duck hunting in 1 week. Others went onto ventilators, and he's not a young person. So that I could have gone on and on with stories of inconsistencies and injustices. Obviously, I only had less than 3 minutes to speak, as it turns out, about my concerns. And then there's the video of what took place later, which was not a direct correlation to my speaking time. It occurred somewhat later.
Yes, the initial reports about the incident suggested that it was the content of your speech that made the board so upset with you. But the hospital then told the Associated Press that your behavior presented a safety risk and violated a clearly set rule of decorum for the public meeting. Did you do anything outrageous and inappropriate to make the board call the police on you?
Yeah, no, that's what's really upsetting to me in retrospect, is that this should have been avoided. I really simply walked over to a sympathetic board member to give her my thanks for supporting me. I needed to get back in the car and drive back to Ocala, Florida, 2.5 hours with my wife. And instead, I was approached in an unexpected way by not one or two, but actually three uniformed officers, as it turns out. So, some people, I don't want to be a hero for this. I just want it to be known that I believe the hospital overreacted. And I think had I been a friendly person in their mind, if I had been supporting their narrative, I don't believe they would have had me treated this way. I guess it's up to others who know about the security there to answer that question.
Well, it's been common knowledge that large hospital systems don't like to use generic medicines on their patients because they are incentivized by the government to use expensive drugs, even though those latter may not be necessarily safe or effective. But how much do you think the frustration with your promotion of ivermectin affected the board's decision to treat you the way they did?
Well, it's clear to me that the hospitals have pretty much drawn a line you know, where they're going to allow dialogue at a professional level to take place. This was never the case in medicine before COVID. If there was a medication alternative or otherwise, and honestly, this is a Nobel Prize winning medicine for human consumption, and they keep referring to it as an antiparasitic for horses and forgetting how much it's used. And not only is it useful as an antiparasitic, it was derived from the same streptomyces plant that produced Zithromax, the Z-Pak, that is used widely for human consumption. So it does have anti-inflammatory, antiviral, and anti-parasitic properties, all three, making it a very unique drug that needs to be utilized more. So the fact that we couldn't have this conversation, it sort of remains somewhat of a mystery that I think people are beginning to figure out. The hospitals clearly did not want something that was so readily available to the public to be used to keep people out of the hospitals and or to shorten their hospital length of stay. You know, and then you get into all the theories that I'm not really an expert about, but it was disheartening to me to see patients being denied ivermectin in the hospital. One hospital here right across the street from me said, we're only going to allow patients to get ivermectin once they're in the critical care unit, either on a ventilator before, which made no sense because the mechanism of action is to prevent the virus from doing the damage ahead of time, you know, the inflammatory cascade, the cytokine storm that we all heard about in the public. So no, nothing really made sense scientifically. And so, yeah, clearly I infuriated at least one board member because it was stated to me after the meeting that she's the one who signaled the security to come and take me out of the room. And you've heard me tweet maybe about that. It wasn't even that. If they had just said, if they had been nice to me and said, Dr. Littell, I'm sorry that we've been asked to have to leave you, to take you out, it's some kind of something. But it was really, I was treated for the first time in my career as a thug, and I didn't appreciate it, but I didn't know how to react, frankly. I was shocked.
Have you been to other board meetings before? Do they really have such strict protocols for the way people can or cannot behave?
This was my first time at an actual board of trustees meeting for a hospital. I've been in other meetings, but a public board meeting, but I heard after from other folks that they had never been screening every bag that went in. You know, it was being screened like we were going into a concert or a Disney World. That's the first time all that they had 15 security, a detailed 15 security people. This apparently was because one board member felt as though she was going to be threatened somehow. This is what I'm hearing secondhand, so I'm not going to comment. None of this made sense from the point of view. The worst thing that happened at that meeting, frankly, this was supposed to be a meeting to address the concerns of people who lost loved ones during COVID. And they stacked the auditorium, as I'm sure you've heard, with people who were just talking about how wonderful it was to have my baby there, or how you took care of my husband, you know, 5 years ago when I've been on the heat. And this had nothing to do with the substance. It should have been a meeting focusing on that issue. And if they had just been willing to have a conversation and shown a little kindness, I believe they would have been, as I said many times, they would have become the best hospital in Florida because they would have been willing to listen.
So it looks like the hospitals are turning into really dangerous places for people to be at when they're sick and vulnerable.
Yeah. Hospitals have been dangerous places for decades. All right, this is nothing new. I mean, I was chief of staff at a large hospital in Orlando, and we went to many meetings discussing the errors that take place in hospital. You can go on and on and on about the many things that happen with the depersonalization of healthcare. The irony of all of what happened in COVID is that one large hospital system here said, while I was chief of staff, they made a thrust on something called the patient experience. They said, we're going to start getting every doctor to realize what it's like to be a patient in the hospital bed. And as a part of the exercise, they wanted us to start sitting on the hospital bed with patients and holding their hands, okay, to increase communication. Because there are doctors who, let's face it, lack the natural skill to empathize and interpersonal skills. So they're teaching doctors, which, you know, who knows how that would have worked. This was just, you know, a couple of years before COVID. Then all of a sudden COVID happens and the same hospital system said, okay, hospitalists taking care of COVID patients, you don't need to see them in their rooms right now at all. You can dial in. They'll have a phone. You can call them on the phone, check on them. So the patient experience was no longer an issue for that hospital. it was now, I didn't know what you could call it. It was a horrific experience for patients. I can recall one gentleman who came here to visit his children. He was from Chile, not my patient. Family was not my patients. They were not my patients. But the daughter heard I was rounding, and she said, "Dr. Littell, could you go see my dad? He just got off a plane from Chile. He's got COVID, and they put him in isolation. He doesn't speak a lick of English. So he comes from another country. He's put in an isolation ward, and he's pretty much thinking he's going to die." I went up there. I saw him. I saw his oxygen level was not anywhere near where he needed to even be in the hospital. And I was able to get him transferred to my service. I got him discharged home. And he did fine. He did fine at home. But God knows what would have happened to him had he stayed in a hospital where nobody would speak to him in his language, essentially, and where he would have felt abandoned. No family members, you know, just coming off a plane and no one could see him. That was his advocate. So, you know, that's what I found myself doing a lot for several months.
How many doctors in America do prescribe ivermectin? Getting back to our previous topic.
Oh, the ivermectin is...
For COVID, I mean.
It's really becoming more prescribed by doctors than you would imagine, including many who contacted me. The problem is not prescribing it. The problem is getting pharmacies to fill the prescription. To this day, Walgreens, CVS, Rite Aid, Kroger, none of them will fill prescriptions for ivermectin unless you specify that it's for a parasite, such as creeping eruption, or, you know, one of the things that we see as a skin or GI parasite. So no, we still have a tremendous resistance. And so that leaves us with compounding pharmacists, which are, you know, not always available for the public to get to, but they are more in number, and they're being persecuted as well. So it's not an issue of how many are prescribing. I would have to say that you're seeing more and more figuring it out. And of course, you know what's happening with the horse ivermectin. You know, animal people are using that paste, and veterinarians are figuring out how to compound that in a way, and I'm not endorsing that, mind you, but they did do that because these are doctors of veterinary medicine. They figured if it works for my horse, it's going to work for me, and it did, actually, in some respects. I am not endorsing that. I'm just saying that the veterinarians who came up to me said that that was their only choice because they couldn't get a doctor to prescribe the human form of ivermectin. So if we can ever get to the point where we have an academic discussion about its utility that's honest, then I think you'll see ivermectin become, as I've said, one of the top three drugs that I want in my arsenal for treating patients. Prednisone is number one, azithromycin, which is very related, number two, the Z-Pak, and number three would be ivermectin.
Doctor, I want to ask you this. On your website, one of the first banners that you see is a link to the documentary of the Children's Health Defense titled Infertility, a Diabolical Agenda. Please tell us why you were endorsing the movie.
Well, that happened because of because of COVID, I got to meet some interesting people, among them Bobby Kennedy Jr., who was, when he heard I'd written a book about Gardasil, the HPV vaccine, I was involved in the early stages. I always went to meetings to learn more. And when I heard this vaccine was being rolled out, I was already doing a lot of women's healthcare, a lot of screening for cervical cancer. And so I went to the meetings around the country, and especially the big one in Orlando, where they rolled out the vaccine. And that's when I discovered that this was a massive campaign to deceive women about Gardasil. It was in the process of that, at the same conference, that I met the mastermind behind the population control agenda that Bill Gates has implemented in Africa. And that's what I was able to contribute to in his movie on the epidemic of infertility in Africa. It's in my book. It's also in at the end of the movie that Bobby Kennedy made on the diabolical agenda.
Doctor, do you think that the suppression of early treatments, along with other federally dictated pandemic measures, such as vaccine mandates, could be a part of the diabolical agenda of population control?
No doubt in my mind. Absolutely. No doubt in my mind that we're seeing all sorts of assaults on fertility in women and men. And you just have to look at the statistics on reducing sperm counts in men across every, it used to be just the first world nations. Now you're seeing it in third world nations because these rollouts of all sorts of unproven and untested vaccines. And unnecessary vaccines, I might add, unnecessary vaccines. So that can have an impact at multiple levels on fertility. And you've heard many people discuss the COVID vaccines, those injections, how they work on the reproductive health of women. So now ultimately, this is something I realized when I wrote The Hidden Truth, that there has been a decades-long plan. You just have to look, as I wrote in my book, about Bill Gates discussing how he could come up with a computer chip to implant in women to be able to regulate their fertility remotely. That was Bill Gates' thinking. So this is sort of a very, should be troubling to every mother of every child. When you send your child, your teenage daughter, to the doctors anymore, and they're discussing vaccines, they may not be talking or thinking even about future fertility. But the manufacturers of these vaccines, you know, have a plan. I know they have a plan.
Dr. Littiel, I would like to thank you so much for your time today. Please tell us what's the best way to follow you and your work and how to find your book that you just mentioned, The Hidden Truth.
Yes, thank you. Well, my website is johnlittielmd.com, and I finally got on Twitter because of Dr. Robert Malone getting me, nudging me, but realize I see a boatload of patients and I have a big family, and they are my priority, but I will do what I can do as long as the good Lord gives me energy to do it.
All right. And how about your book? Is it available on Amazon or elsewhere?
Yeah, try to get it on my website because they pay me a few bucks more than Amazon does. So go to my website. It's iUniverse. And yeah, seriously, you get paid like $2 a book or something from Amazon. But I don't, it's not about the money. It's about getting the truth out to people. And if you read the book, share it with a friend, because my goal in life is just to help women be the women that God intended them to be. And we tend to mess them up in medicine big time, unfortunately.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Next up, two members of the John Birch Society legislative team discuss why ranked choice voting is a bad alternative for restoring sound constitutional government.
This is Christian Gomez for The New American and also the research project manager here at the John Birch Society. And I'm joined today with Peter Rakowski, research associate for the John Birch Society. Hi, Peter. Welcome again to the program.
Thanks, Christian. It's great to be on.
So today we're discussing, as we always usually do, legislative alerts and what's happening sometimes in the Capitol Hill. But today we'll be focusing what's happening in the different states. And there are some efforts going on with regards to ranked choice voting in some states. Can you first tell the audience what exactly ranked choice voting is and why it's a bad thing and what states this is happening in?
Yeah, ranked choice voting is a new form of voting that states and municipalities across the country are gradually implementing. So what it is instead of voting, so under the normal voting system, we vote for the candidate that we support. So if we support candidate A, we'll vote for candidate A. If we don't support candidate B or C or D, we won't vote for that candidate.
And whoever gets the most votes wins, winner takes all.
Right, yeah. With ranked choice voting, we rank the candidates in order. So 1, 2, 3, so on. So in a sense, we vote for each candidate. We just rank them in an order of preference.
So like first choice, second choice, etc.
Right.
And
so,
go on.
So then that's how the voting is. And then when the counting begins, the candidate with the lowest number of first choice votes gets eliminated. And then that candidate, where the voters put that candidate first on the ballot, then their second choice vote will be counted
as their first choice.
Right.
Wow.
And then that process will repeat. So then once that's counted, if a candidate still does not have a majority of the votes, then the next lowest candidate is eliminated, and then that candidate's second choice. So the voters who put that candidate first and the second choice becomes the first choice. And that process is repeated over and over again until one candidate has over 50% of the vote.
That sounds a little convoluted, but can you tell us in what states already have this? But before that even, could you just explain really briefly, like, who benefits from this? Like, ideologically speaking, does this benefit liberals? Does it benefit constitutional conservatives? Or does it benefit those in between? Who'd you say benefits the most and the least from this convoluted form of voting?
It practically benefits every side except the constitutional conservatives. So we see states like Alaska, we see states like Maine, that both of them implemented ranked choice voting for the state level elections.
Didn't Sarah Palin run for the congressional seat at large last election, running as a pretty conservative candidate, actually, and they had this ranked choice voting there, right? What happened in that state?
Yeah, a Democrat won the election. A left-wing Democrat won the election for Alaska's single U.S. representative. And that was because of the ranked choice voting. That Democrat did not win a majority of the votes in the first round.
And Alaska's typically like a red-leaning conservative state. I mean, you look at the presidential elections, you never see Alaska at large ever go for like a Democrat. So this is pretty... This is a pretty big deal then, if you can change a state that leans red to go blue. So what happened, I take it, was that there were three candidates running in that race primarily?
Yeah, there was Sarah Palin, who was a pretty conservative candidate, as you mentioned, and there was a very moderate rhino establishment Republican as well, and then a left-wing Democrat. The Democrat won, and then the moderate rhino Republican took votes away from that would have otherwise gone to Sarah Palin. And because of that, she lost the election to the Democrats. So the Democrat benefited. We see the same thing in Alaska's U.S. Senate election, where Lisa Murkowski, who's one of the most left-wing Republicans in the U.S. Senate, she won the election, even though under the old system, the traditional voting system, she would have easily lost the Republican primary, have been eliminated, and then an actual conservative candidate, Republican candidate, would have won the election there. But because of the ranked choice voting system, she won the election again in Alaska.
So does any state have that now where there's an effort being made to get rid of it?
Right. Yeah, there is. In Utah, there is a bill, House Bill 171, which has been introduced that would get rid of the states. So what Utah has done, they haven't implemented ranked choice voting for the entire state for every election. They've done it only for municipal elections.
So just the local races, basically.
Right.
Okay.
And not even for all municipalities, okay. Just some. So this bill, but it's still a slippery slope towards eventually ranked choice voting for all elections. So what this bill would do is eliminate that.
Statewide, so nobody can do it.
Right. No ranked choice voting whatsoever. House Bill 171.
So how could those who live in Utah, for example, what can they do to get this bill passed to prevent ranked choice voting from proceeding in the state?
Right. Yeah. Any resident in Utah needs to contact their state representative, their state senator. Tell them to support House Bill 171 along with any other bill that would end ranked choice voting completely in the state. And then also, we at the John Birch Society provide a legislative alert supporting that, which makes the process very easy to do that.
So how do people get to those alerts?
Right, on jbs.org/alerts. And on that page, we have all of our legislative alerts, federal, state. If you scroll down, there's a map of the United States with each state. If you click on Utah, you'll see that alert opposing ranked choice voting. And that's how you get to the alert. We have alerts also opposing ranked choice voting bills in other states.
Where they don't already have it. You mean like to stop it from happening? Because this is going to be something that's going to be introduced in probably at some point every single state in the union. So what are some states where they're trying to get it passed, where they don't have it yet, but they want to get it passed and we have alerts that people can use to stop it?
Right, yeah. So we have alerts right now for Georgia, for Oregon, for Illinois, for Wyoming, for a few other states as well, bills that would implement ranked choice voting either statewide, or for only municipalities. And so for we have alerts for those states. And so once again, on jbs.org/alerts, we have those pages up on the state level for those specific states. We also have a 50-state alert. So even if you have you live in a state that does not have a specific bill that's been introduced in the legislature, it's still important to tell to contact the legislators preemptively, telling them, you know, hey, ranked choice voting is a terrible idea. We need to oppose this. To contact them preemptively, we have an alert for that as well.
So let's say we live in Wisconsin here, or somebody lives in South Carolina or let's stick with Wisconsin or South Carolina. Someone lives in one of those states right now where there isn't ranked choice voting and nothing has been introduced yet. What would we do? We would go to jbs.org, click on the legislative alerts, and then click on where that map is. We can click on Wisconsin or click on or whatever state you're in, and when you click on your state, it'll be there. Is that how you find the nationwide alert?
That's right. Yeah, click on any state, scroll down, and then that alert, along with every other alert that targets all 50 states, it'll be right there underneath each state.
Absolutely. Well, this is a really important topic, and thank you for joining us today to discuss it, because this is something that needs to be stopped, really exposed and stopped, especially before 2024. Well, that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us today in this segment, and we'll be back for the rest of the program after this break.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for the New American Magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American Magazine represents an alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
Conservatives and pro-life activists have a lot to learn about communications, organizing, and winning. And the Leadership Institute is ready to help with that. The New American's Alex Newman recently interviewed the Institute's Director of Coalitions, Dina Espenscheid.
And so I understand you guys are working on some pro-life initiatives that are going to be unveiled soon. What can you tell us about it?
Yes, I'm very excited about this project. So Leadership Institute is a 501c3 nonpartisan nonprofit. We've trained over 258,000 people over the last 43 years. And this is the first time that we're really reaching out to groups that have a special interest need, specifically pro-life groups, and going to them and saying, what are your needs? And then bringing the training that they need to them and to their people. And it was a test project last year. So far, we've trained over 1,000 pro-life advocates.
Wow. And so what are you training them to do? I've gone through some of the trainings. They're phenomenal. But so what are you training these activists specifically to do?
Excellent. So one of the most popular trainings is a communications training. So pro-life organizations, pro-life advocates just need to be able to tell their story better. So we help them craft their messaging and craft their stories. And we do that by giving them the basic Leadership Institute message development training, but then also talk about what words specifically do pro-life activists need to be using in order to properly persuade their audience. So, for example, we don't call them crisis pregnancy centers anymore because babies are not crises. The women that are seeking help are looking for help. So they're pregnancy help centers or pregnancy resource centers. And once we can get our activists to stop saying things like crisis pregnancy center and start saying pregnancy help center, people better understand what we're doing and what we give back to the community.
Yeah, so the left is really good at the manipulation of language, and I guess conservatives haven't quite wrapped their arms around this yet. But what are some tips that you have to make conservatives more effective generally in terms of, you know, political issues, communication, organizing, grassroots things?
I guess the big thing is to go out there and do it. I mean, I got my start as a volunteer door knocking on political campaigns, and door knocking became, and volunteering on door knocking became leading volunteers, became working on campaigns, organizing the volunteers, became working on presidential campaigns, organizing volunteers in four different states. So that's number one thing, is just do something. And then the second thing is to tell your stories. So often, we as conservatives, we love statistics. The statistics are always on our side. Look how bad the economy is. Look how much abortion hurts women. Look how many people regret their abortions. But when you talk in statistics, they're not caring, they're not feeling, and they don't move the average person. If instead you could talk about, in South Dakota, we knew an 18-year-old who had been coerced into an abortion by her father. He took her to Planned Parenthood under the guise of, oh, we're just going to give you a pregnancy test. And instead, they strapped her down and took her baby from her while she was screaming, no, no, I want my baby. Can we all agree that forced abortion should not happen? That is a true story, by the way, and it happens more often than not. But when we can tell stories like that, we can get agreement across the crowd. There's not a single person out there that's going, no, I think we should force people into abortion. And if they are, they're cruel, cruel, horrible animals. And so when we can get people to start agreeing with us, then it's easier to change the policy out there. Excellent. So those are the two things.
And how do people get connected with Ally? How would people, say, bring a training to their state, to their city, to get their people trained?
They can absolutely reach out to me. I'd love to bring a training to their community. We also do weekly or monthly webinars. And the Leadership Institute does over 1,000 trainings per year. So there's something always going on at the Leadership Institute. You can see the full list of things at leadershipinstitute.org. Or if you're specifically looking for pro-life information, leadershipinstitute.org/pro-life, and I can be found there.
And so you guys are nonpartisan, so it's, mm-hmm. it's not like about training Republicans. This is about conservatives and people who want to preserve freedom, protect life, things like that. Huh?
Yes, everything that we train on can be used by any campaign, any activist, at any policy, whether you're trying to fundraise for your pregnancy care center or you're trying to fundraise for a ministry that saves horses from the slaughterhouse. I've trained people that do that before. So it really is broad-based, and what we teach can be applied to any topic. So even if you're like, well, I really don't care about pro-life so much, but I'm pro-gun, I can help you with that.
Yeah, fantastic, Dina. And the website one more time, and any final thoughts on how people get involved?
Sure thing. Leadershipinstitute.org is our website, and people just get involved. Pull up the magic Google machine and just type in your local party of your choice or the local campaign of your choice or the local pregnancy care center, and just look and then call them up and ask, what can I do to volunteer? That's how you get involved.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Dina. We appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The New American TV. We will see you tomorrow.